This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Julian Ng, and today on The Breakfast Grill is David Hashim, founder and president of the Veritas Group, which is an architecture firm with billings of over 100 million ringgit in 2018. They have offices around the world, Dubai, Vietnam, Australia, UK, US and India, and employs over 300 professional and support staff. Veritas also has other lines of business like master planning, interior design, landscaping and quantity surveying. And some of their work include One Central, One Monkeara, Gussing Heights, 1, 2 and 3, 4 MRT stations, International School KL, as well as landscaping for Legoland. And we'll talk about the architectural and urban development landscape in Malaysia and around the world today. David, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Julian. Glad to be here.
Now, let's look at your mission and core principles. From your website, you are flexible and adaptable in approaching projects. You don't follow a fixed stylistic signature, but are inspired by principles of good design and a sensitive response to site and context. And you have a core purpose to elevate the quality of our built environment for the pleasure of humanity. What does all this mean to a layperson?
Well, I think when we began the practice 32 years ago, we began to think about what it was that was important to us, that would inspire us for a whole career of work, the kind of ideals that would eventually translate into great work for the people who occupy our spaces and our buildings. And the idea of declaring pleasure as a goal was very inspiring, because if you think about it, the world doesn't need architects. You need builders to build your homes. You need engineers to make sure they stand up. But why architecture? And the answer is, we bring something new and special to a project, which is design. And what's the importance of design is to achieve beauty. And so ultimately, I think people everywhere in the world need beauty in their lives, and that's why they buy expensive art or expensive designer items and fashion. And so in the field of construction, we architects bring beauty. So I think these were inspiring ideas in the beginning, and I do think they translate to better work on the ground for the people.
So that's very interesting, because when you talk about beauty and your stylistic signature, would you give up aesthetics for design? Do ugly buildings, for example, have a place?
Well, I think the being beautiful or ugly is a little bit subjective, but most people would agree that is something that a particular building is or space or place is attractive. And I think it is important. I've been in places which are profoundly beautiful, and it makes you stop and reflect on yourself, on life, on your relationship with people. So I am a believer that great buildings and great places make people better. They actually make you think about your role in, say, society or your role in a community. So good design, I believe, encourages a more conscientious view of your role in the world.
This morning, David Hashim, founder and president of the Veritas Group, is on The Breakfast Grill. Now, David, let's sort of take a deep dive into what you've just said and look into master planning, which is one of your lines of businesses. And this is a very pertinent area in our developmental stage. And there are some ongoing master planning proposals in your portfolio. The Kota Siaramas 2,400-acre township in Negeri Sembilan, and then also Tapa Edu City, 3,500 acres with 650 acres devoted to high-skill education. What are some of the design considerations for projects such as these?
Yeah. Well, I think some of the trends in planning are, first of all, to move away from vehicular oriented planning. In the past, the car and the vehicle were considered the primary aspects to consider. But now, with environmental sustainability being an increasingly important factor, we begin to move away from those automated forms of movement and think about master planning as a successful integration of pedestrianization with greenery, landscape, creating a sustainable smart environment. And by smart environment, I mean smart transportation, smart energy consumption, smart waste recycling, smart energy conservation. These are becoming more and more critical in master plans. The larger the project, the more the opportunity to do better, more long-term sustainability planning and design. And so all these projects that you've just mentioned, we start with these as the basis, trying to create nodes or places within the plan that allow you to walk instead of drive a car, covered walkways, covered linkways, bridges, and all the buildings in the plan also need to be designed to be green. It means low energy consumption, the recycling of waste and capturing of water, photovoltaics if you can afford them, other means of creating energy, solar panels, and in fact, in some cases, in some of those projects, we're introducing a biodigester plant. A biodigester plant takes the cuttings from the landscape, puts it into an anaerobic digester, which creates methane, which is then compressed and stored and can be used in kitchens. So these are some of the new trends that we see that were not around really, or nobody would care about them or invest in them 10, 20 years ago. Now they are very important.
Are you getting the buy-ins of the stakeholders, the local governments, the government itself, your clients?
Yes. And I think there's two reasons for that. The first one is that people want it. People want to feel that they're doing something for the environment. So there's a sense of conscientiousness, a care that is becoming more and more important. I was just reading the paper today about the plastic problem that's infesting our country. So we all have a role to play in helping. The second thing is that it comes down to dollars and cents. And you can a good design can actually make a very strong case for a short-term recovery on the capital investment to do that. So, for example, a good photovoltaic system can get a return in, say, 5 to 7 years. A good water catchment and recycling system can get a return on investment within 2 years. So all these things are money in your pocket. So on one hand, we are trying to get people to appreciate these things from a sense of conscientiousness. Secondly, we're speaking to their wallet. And
okay,
I think both of them are important.
So we get a sense of those two things. Now, you have an office, branch office in Georgetown. What do you think about the Penang Transport Master Plan, which is very controversial and for its negative environment and funding perceptions? You must be quite close to the pulse.
A little bit. I mean, I'm a transplanted Penang boy,
okay.
Penang family, but moved to Klang Valley many years ago. I think that there's a lot of negative perception of the PIL and the overall transportation scheme for Penang. And
Do we really need islands? Seriously?
Well, we need
man-made islands.
We need to pay for the PIL, and there's a lot of investment that has to go into the construction.
But do we need them? I mean, are there any other ideas? Can we use more of a Penang mainland, for example?
Yeah, well, it's hard to. People love Penang Island, you look at places like Hong Kong, you look at Singapore, and the amount of reclamation that has happened there. It's not. The initial reactions were always a little bit negative, but once the places are, once the new land is there and people have moved in, they become to be accepted and become homes. I think that the necessary environmental impacts need to be done. There is good reclamation and then there is bad reclamation. So it can be done well. Unfortunately, in Malaysia, there's been a lot of experience of these things not done properly and not done well and having a larger negative impact on, say, the water. So I am hopeful. And I do think Penang means it because, you know, if you go to Penang on some weekends, you just can't get around. You can't move around. And public transportation alone is not going to help it. It needs some roads. It needs some highways. So I'm a supporter of it.
Okay, you're a supporter of it because, in your words, people want it. But we also have to think about it in the form of a conceptual framework of whether this is good for Penang or not. Not only necessarily because people want it. And in that vein, I guess Think City, which is established under Khazanah, an agency that does a lot of work in Penang, conservation and restorative work. What kind of KPIs should we look at here when we look at benefits to society? The benefits could be intangible, but how do you pitch the idea to the rest of the general masses who are very concerned with bread and butter issues? And when they find out that the money is being spent, they're concerned about these other issues.
Mm. Well, if you look at, you said the money being spent, I think we have to understand these are private investment initiatives. The reclamation and the creation of the new land is something the government has allowed to proceed. Well, actually, it's not been officially approved yet. It's going through a series of stages and environmental impact assessments and so on. But if it's done right, then it will not be taxpayers' money.
That's societal costs, though, right?
There's always going to be social impact. But the for example, the reclamation of those three islands, Island A, B, C, at the southern tip of Penang, I think the perception, negative perception, will be from those residents who own existing beachfront and those communities. They have to be part of the process. They have to be engaged as stakeholders because they will be the first people to be impacted. Instead of looking out at a beautiful waterfront, they'll be looking out at islands. So they have to be brought into the decision making process. They have to benefit from it, and if they don't, then it's wrong. It's absolutely wrong.
Yeah, David, I grew up in SS2, right? That was my childhood neighborhood. And I look at that today and it's so congested. And I don't think it causes pleasure or happiness in me when I look at the traffic jams and the messiness of the place. So how do you restructure, on the one hand, an old neighborhood and an old town? How do you upgrade that? Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, when we are starting from a clean slate, shouldn't we think for the long term about good ideas, right? Especially when we're talking about, constructing man-made islands, So I guess two questions in one there.
I'm going to look at a bit more macro than what you've just mentioned, okay? The country is growing. The population is growing, number one. Number two, because of the lure of the economic incentives to move to urban centers, because anybody who lives in a city earns so much more than somebody who lives in the outskirts. There's a natural migration of people to the cities. And then there's a natural population growth, not even including migration from foreigners moving to Malaysia. So all these factors are instigating our cities to need to be more dense. So you could have a sentimental view of the past where you used to be surrounded by nice bungalows and, greenery and apartments. Where is everyone going to live? We all have to change our expectations, and the cities have to transform to becoming more dense. There's no choice unless population stops growing, which isn't going to happen. So I think we just have to adapt to places like, to things like in Penang, where new islands are being built and homes are going to be built on them. Or if you live in a nice part of SS2, you're going to have a condominium coming up right next to you. You can complain about it, but where is everyone going to go otherwise?
We have David Hashim, founder and president of the Veritas Group, on The Breakfast Grill this morning. And coming back, we'll talk about further developmental issues in architecture. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
David Hashim, founder and president of the Veritas Group, is on the Breakfast Grill this morning. And David, earlier on, we were talking about comfort levels in new and old urban developments. And just looking into more detail about some of your ongoing projects or proposed projects, you have the Planet Hollywood Hotel, which features a 60-meter span sky wheel that is visible from 100 miles away. What is the? I'm just wondering, setting aside commercial considerations, what is the architectural narrative here, because the sky wheel is, along the lines of the famous Ferris wheels across the world, you know, the London Eye, the Singapore Flyer. And this can be characterized as high-priced playgrounds, right? So can you maybe give us some insights into the architectural narrative here?
Projects like that, we call it the Skywheel, are part of a new generation of towers, which I call the democratization of the skyline. You see what I mean by that?
It's very the entry price into Singapore Flyer, for example. You know, is so expensive to get in, and is not necessarily democratizing.
Well, what I mean by that is, in the past, the highest priced properties were up in the skyline, whether it's a high end apartment or an office tower or even a hotel room in the sky. These are things beyond the capability of the average person to enjoy. And so that view of the skyline from being up in the clouds is something that only the very wealthy would be able to enjoy. Now, the transformation that I'm talking about, and many of the projects we're working on, is allowing the rakyat, the public, to be able to enter those realms up in the clouds. And many of these places are free. You don't have to go on the wheel to go up there. That's a separate, you know, price to a ticket item. But just for the time taken to go up in a lift and up into the sky, whether you're up in a bar or a restaurant or a club or doing some shopping or enjoying a wheel in the sky, these are all ways for the people to finally enter the realm of the super rich. And for of a ticket in some cases.
Is that a good thing? Because I read a lot, and in preparation for this interview, I read a lot of the architecture literature out there. And a lot of architects around the world, perhaps in the minority, are concerned about architectural developments across the world in a sense that this is causing a lot of, design is causing a lot of inequality in the world, and there's a lot of gentrification going on. Now, is something like gentrification, is that happening too quickly? Is that a good thing? For example, you know, we see a lot of the traditional businesses, businesses in Penang, being pushed out because of the opening up to tourism. Now, is that a good thing?
I know what you're talking about. In Georgetown, we're very familiar with what's happening down in the UNESCO Heritage Site, where a lot of the older shop lots are being bought over and being converted into high-end hotels, and people are being forced. I think that's, you know, that's a natural evolution that that, you know, it's going to happen anyway. But as an architect, we are not fully in control of the larger macroeconomic transformation. So we do what we can to enable places to remain, to give them some character, to remain some of the historical character. But I do notice that in Georgetown, the older offices are moving out. And in some cases, they're moving into high-rise office buildings, and those old shops are now being turned into tourist backpackers, or, you know, it's not just high end. It's also some very affordable housing that's happening in the old parts of Georgetown. So I think, you know, one thing I don't want to see happen is where government policy comes in to sort of control everything. I'm more of a free market thinker. I think that allow people to make decisions based on what is good for them. And that's the way that the trend should happen. So as people move out, other businesses move in. It's all part of the continuing transformation. And I don't believe that historic buildings like in Georgetown, since you mentioned it, should remain as what they are. They should transform. By saying that, I don't mean that we change the historical character of the buildings, but the functions can change. What was a shop house can become a boutique. What was a shop house can become a bar or a restaurant or a backpacker's hotel. That's natural, and I think that's a good thing.
And speaking of free market, in fact, today there is news that there is a proposal from the Hotels Association to for Airbnb Airbnb owners to cap long stay periods. Where do you stand on that? I mean, capping it to, I think, 180 days.
Oh, I'm a big Airbnb fan.
But in terms of residential abodes being opened up to the free market and disturbing the local neighborhoods, I guess this is where the hoteliers, they might have a self-interest there, but they're proposing to cap the number of days, 180 days, yeah. I think, for short stay.
Yeah, you know, I know the whole controversy, and I just think that these are just, I would say, desperate attempts to protect the hotel industry, and on one hand, and also desperate attempts by residents in condominiums and apartments to prevent their neighbors from renting out and having transitory guests coming through. But all of this, I see, it's the same battle that's happening on the street with ride sharing. You know, in the end of the day, it's inevitable. These things are the world is transforming. And we either move with the flow or we're going to lose the battle. So I'm a big fan of Airbnb, and I know the controversies. I know the issues, you know, security and privacy. But I think it's a trend that's going to be inevitable. The whole world is going to be Airbnb. The whole world is going to be Grab and Uber.
Okay, let's talk about some of your global footprint. From a design perspective, why do you want to go into the rest of the world, right? You have offices everywhere in the world, UK, US. Is it to transfer local knowledge over there, or is it to acquire foreign knowledge and to adapt it to your design overall design portfolio?
Well, Julian, I think first of all, it wasn't even that strategic.
Okay. To make money, is it?
Well, no, not even that. I think it's partly my own personal sense of adventure. Maybe it's my DNA. I'm a very multicultural, multi-ethnic background, and I've always had a passion for travel. And so the idea of just being a juara kampong, if you're familiar with the phrase,
yes,
it was never very attractive to me. I always wanted to learn more about the world, and the world is such a vast place. Malaysia is only a population of 31 million people within a 7 billion population of the world. It doesn't make sense.
And what do they say to you? Like, how dare you come into our neighborhood? You're from Malaysia, you know, a land where people possibly still live in trees. Like, how dare you come over here and propose design features to us? What do they say, those kind of things? And how do you react to it?
Maybe in the beginning, but not so much now. No, I think we are welcomed because we are seen as a group of people which are trying to build networks and relationships across the world. We're not going into the UK or the US or Australia trying to dominate the industry there. We're a small player, but we want to build the connections and the relationships. First of all, Malaysia is a trading nation. Malaysians by nature are adventurous. We were founded by adventurers and explorers traders that came here. So it's in our nature, and it's in my own heritage to go back out to those places and reach out and make those connections. So I'm just reversing something that has been happening for hundreds of years. And it's been fun. I mean, you know, you can get very jaded working in a very small community of Malaysia. But once I get out to Australia, it's different. And once I get out to the U.S., it's different. And what we learn by working in those other environments, we bring the lessons and the knowledge back to Malaysia. And we bring the knowledge of Malaysia out to those places. So for me, it's an exciting mix of interacting with different cultures and people and the things you learn. It's amazing, really amazing. It's extraordinary.
David, we have 1 minute more for the last question. All these incidents around the world concerning buildings, the Grenfell Tower fire, the so-called walkie-talkie building in London that burnt up cars, and closer to home, the EPF building fire. Where does the buck stop on this? Is it the architect? Is it the client? Is it the government?
Each project is unique, Julian. You have to look at the case of the project. And there are so many areas of liability, from the contractor to the architect, for the engineer, for the owner. In most cases now, when things go wrong, everybody gets in trouble. So we have to be very careful about the decisions we make because they do affect a lot of people.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning. And that was David Hashim, founder and president of the Veritas Group. I'm Julian Ng for The Breakfast Grill, BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Now with wider 4G LTE reach. Barula Bears.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.